Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America, designed for people like you who are learning American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz in Washington. Every day of the year on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. Because this program is produced for learners of American English, like you, we speak a little slower than normal, and we use words and phrases that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. This is what you will hear on today's program. We will have a report on Saudi Arabia's increasing use of education to quietly spread the severe form of Islam in Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country. Its believers want Islamic laws, as defined by the Quran, the Islamic holy book, to govern the world. In our weekly science report, Anne Ball will tell us about plans to build the world's largest solar tower in Israel. The country's small solar industry will take a giant leap forward when the new solar tower starts working in 2018. And finally, as we do every Monday, we will present The Making of a Nation. Today, Steve Ember will tell the story of Watergate, the scandal that forced President Richard Nixon to resign. So you can see, as always, we have a lot for you today. So let's get started.
Saudi Arabia has been using education to quietly spread Salafism in Indonesia, the world's most populous Muslim country, since 1980. The two ways Saudi Arabia does this is through the LIPIA and scholarships for higher education in Saudi Arabia. Salafism is a severe form of Islam. Its believers want Islamic laws, as defined by the Quran, to govern the world. The Quran is the Islamic holy book. LIPIA teaches Wahhabi Madhhab, a religious expert from the 1200s. Ibn Taymiyyah led this version of Salafism. People who have studied at LIPIA and in Saudi Arabia hold powerful positions throughout Indonesia, including in a conservative political party and the top levels of government. Some have also become preachers and religious teachers. They work to spread Salafism throughout the country.
An agency linked to the Saudi Arabian embassy in Jakarta gives scholarships to students to study in Saudi Arabia. But Saudi diplomat Saad Namas would not tell VOA how many students are given free education. He said, "We don't really work with the Indonesian government. We just try to strengthen cultural ties between our two countries by, for example, holding Quranic recitation competitions. He said many countries, including the Netherlands and the United States, give scholarships to Indonesian students. He said the Saudi program is just one of many that help students pay for their studies.
Dean Wahid is an expert on Indonesian Salafism at the Sharif Hidayatullah State Islamic University in Jakarta. He says the Saudi agency pays the wages of well-known Salafi preachers and sends Arabic teachers to schools throughout Indonesia. Several Saudi Arabian universities also give scholarships directly to Indonesian students. Dadi Darmadi is a researcher who studies the yearly pilgrimage to Mecca, called the Hajj. Darmadi says the Indonesian government is not likely to try to stop the Saudi efforts. He says it is concerned that Saudi officials might react by limiting the number of Indonesians who can travel to Mecca. Darmadi says Saudi Arabia just gave permission for 10,000 extra Indonesian visitors for the Hajj this year.
Hidayat Nur Wahid is a member of Indonesia's House of Representatives and a leader of the Prosperous Justice Party. He is one of the best-known national politicians to have studied in Saudi Arabia. He received scholarships for undergraduate, master's, and doctorate degrees in theology and the history of Islamic thought at the Islamic University of Medina. In his words, the majority of Islamic texts are in Arabic, which is why I wanted to study in Saudi Arabia. Plus, the spirit of the Prophet Muhammad animates Medina. I enjoyed my years there. Nur Wahid praised his studies in Medina. We just learned how to be good Muslims, he said. And it's a misconception that everyone who studies in Saudi Arabia becomes a preacher or religious teacher. Many graduates become officials or politicians like me.
Researcher Dean Wahid said many Muslims think Saudi Arabia represents true Islam because it is the birthplace of Islam. Some Indonesian officials worry that Saudi-educated preachers are leading Indonesian Muslims to become more conservative in their beliefs. They are even more worried that Salafi teachings could incite terrorism or extremism. Hidayat Nur Wahid says Saudi Arabia is helping many Indonesian students, but that it is not clear what changes Salafism will bring to his country. He says all that is clear is that Salafism is here and it's growing. I'm Marcia James.
And I'm John Russell.
Now, with her weekly science report, here's Ann Ball.
Israel, a sunny country along the Mediterranean Sea, is a perfect place for solar power. Even so, solar power supplies only a small percentage of the country's energy needs. But that situation is beginning to change. In 2018, Israel's small solar industry will take a giant leap forward when a new solar tower starts working. The tower will be 250 meters tall. It will be the tallest solar tower in the world. This information comes from Aaron Gartner, the CEO of Megalim Power Limited, which is responsible for part of the solar project. The power station, Gartner says, will be what is called concentrated solar power. It will be surrounded by 50,000 mirrors spread over 3 square kilometers. The mirrors will concentrate all of the sunlight onto the solar tower. Here is how it works. Gartner explains that a boiler is at the top of the tower. It will use the heat of the sun to turn water into steam. The steam will make a turbine turn. The turning will create power. There are already a dozen similar solar tower fields around the world. Currently, the largest is the Ivanpah plant in California. It has some 170,000 mirrors around 3 towers, which are each 140 meters tall. The new tower, along with 3 other similar solar projects in the Negev Desert, are part of Israel's plans to develop its renewable energy sector. The Israeli government has set a renewable energy target of 10% by 2020. Together, the new solar projects will generate some 310 gigawatts of power, or about 1.6% of the country's energy needs, reports the Associated Press. Aaron Gartner of Megalim Power explains why Israel has not developed its solar power potential before. He says that Israel did not want to dedicate the land necessary for large-scale solar power production. Such large-scale projects also require access to infrastructure, such as water and electricity, which are difficult to connect to remote areas in the Negev Desert. Israel's finance ministry said it has tried to promote the solar industry in other ways. It created incentives for solar power and reduced bureaucracy for Israelis who want to install solar panels on their roofs. Lihi Goldenberg is with the Israel Union Environmental Defense, a nonprofit organization. He says that even though Israel is making progress, it is still behind in taking advantage of its renewable energy. Compared to other countries such as Germany, whose renewable energies, are 35% of its entire energy mix, here in Israel, we're still at 2.5% renewable energies, he said. In addition to its solar potential, Israel has major natural gas deposits offshore. The country now gets some 70% of its energy from natural gas. Yaron Seles is the CEO of Shikun and Binu Renewable Energy, the lead developer of a second solar thermal plot in the Negev Desert. He said the natural gas discovery has delayed the promotion of solar energy. With all the sun we have and how progressed we are in technology, these goals are very, very, very modest, he said. But these are the goals that were set, and we are working toward it. I'm Ann Ball.
Thanks, Ann. Now we present The Making of a Nation. Steve Ember is here to conclude the story of the 37th President of the United States, Richard Nixon. Today, Steve tells us about the scandal that forced Nixon to resign the presidency.
Richard Nixon's first term ended with the hope for a complete American withdrawal from the war in Vietnam. Yet, Americans were still angry about the war and its economic effects on life at home. Inflation and unemployment were both high. Some political observers thought Nixon would not win a second term. Nixon, however, was sure the American people would support him. He did not actively campaign in the state primary elections leading up to the Republican nominating convention. He focused much of his attention on foreign policy, including his historic trip to China in February 1972. In May, he traveled to Austria, the Soviet Union, Iran, and Poland. In Moscow, he signed the first Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, or SALT, with the Soviets. But back in Washington, something happened. It was a small incident, but one that would have a huge effect. On June 17, 1972, five men wearing surgical gloves broke into the headquarters of the Democratic Party. The Democratic National Committee offices were located in one of the buildings in a complex called Watergate. Police caught the burglars, and at the time, the incident did not seem very important. But the men carried papers that linked them to top officials in the Nixon White House. The question was, did the president know what was going on? Nixon denied any wrongdoing. In time, the Watergate break-in would lead to a congressional investigation. But in the summer of 1972, attention focused on the presidential nominating conventions. Democrats met in Miami Beach, Florida, and chose George McGovern, a senator from South Dakota, as their candidate for president. The Republicans also met in Miami Beach, and as expected, nominated Richard Nixon for a second term. McGovern, a liberal, attacked Nixon for his policies on Vietnam. However, Nixon easily won the 1972 election. He defeated McGovern, carrying 49 of the 50 states. But the shadow of Watergate would not go away. Two young reporters for the Washington Post, Bob Woodward and Carl Bernstein, had been following the story since the break-in. In early 1973, they found evidence that linked the break-in to White House officials. The evidence also showed that these officials tried to use government agencies to hide the connection. The burglars had been financed with money connected to the committee to re-elect the president. Pressure grew for a full investigation. In April, President Nixon ordered the Justice Department to carry it out. Attorney General Elliot Richardson appointed law professor Archibald Cox as a special prosecutor to lead the investigation.
The committee will come to Alma.
In May, a special Senate committee began its own investigation. A former White House lawyer, John Dean, provided the major evidence.
It is my honest belief that while the president was involved, that he did not realize or appreciate at any time the implications of his involvement. And I think that when the facts come out, I hope the president is forgiven.
By July, the public learned that President Nixon had made tape recordings of some of his discussions and telephone calls. The Senate committee asked him for some of the tapes. Nixon refused. He said, "The President of the United States has a constitutional right to keep such records private." A federal judge, John Sirica, ordered the president to surrender the tapes. Lawyers for the president took the case to the Supreme Court. The High Court supported Sirica's decision. After that, pressure increased for Nixon to cooperate. In October, he offered to provide written transcripts of parts of the recordings. Archibald Cox, the special prosecutor, rejected the offer. So Nixon ordered Attorney General Richardson to dismiss him. Richardson, the nation's top law enforcement officer, refused. Instead, he resigned, as did his deputy, William Ruckelshaus, when Nixon ordered him to fire Cox.
The Watergate drama has taken a half year to unfold. The president's unique actions in firing two popular and respected members of the executive branch and forcing a third to quit took less than 8 hours. The impact of all this, clearly colossal and yet to be measured.
Jerry Landay reporting for ABC News. The incident happened on a Saturday night and became known as the Saturday Night Massacre. Nixon then had Acting Attorney General Robert Bork dismiss Cox, and the president eliminated the office of special prosecutor. He gave the Justice Department the responsibility of continuing the investigation. President Nixon had another political problem in addition to Watergate. In late 1973, his vice president, Spiro Agnew, was forced to resign. A court had found Agnew guilty of violating tax laws. President Nixon asked Gerald Ford to become the new vice president. Ford was a longtime member of Congress from Michigan. By that time, some members of Congress were talking about trying to remove Nixon from office. Was the president covering up important evidence in the Watergate case? Was he, in fact, guilty of crimes? In April 1974, Nixon surrendered some of the recordings of conversations in his office. However, three important ones were missing. The Nixon administration tried to explain, saying the tape machine had failed to record two of those conversations. The third recording, it said, had been erased accidentally. This became known as the famous 18-minute gap. Many Americans did not believe these explanations. 2 months later, the Supreme Court ruled that a president cannot hold back evidence in a criminal case. It said there is no presidential right of privacy in such a case. Congress moved ahead with efforts to bring charges against the president.
Congress now has no alternative but to institute impeachment proceedings.
In July 1974, a committee in the House of Representatives proposed to impeach Nixon, that is, put the president on trial in the Senate. If Nixon were found guilty of crimes connected to the Watergate case, he would be removed from office. Finally, Nixon surrendered the last of the documents sought by congressional investigators. These documents appeared to provide proof that the president had ordered a cover-up of evidence in the Watergate burglary. Every president promises to protect and defend the Constitution. The congressional investigation showed that Nixon had repeatedly misused government agencies in an effort to hide wrongdoing and punish his critics. The hearings also showed that he had tried to block the investigation. On August 8, 1974, Richard Nixon spoke to the nation. His long struggle to remain in office was over.
Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
By resigning, Nixon avoided impeachment and possible imprisonment. Never before had an American president resigned. On August 9th, Nixon's vice president, Gerald Ford, was sworn in as the nation's 38th president. Soon after becoming president, Gerald Ford made a surprise announcement.
I deeply believe in equal justice for all Americans, whatever their station or former station. But it is not the ultimate fate of Richard Nixon that most concerns me, though surely it deeply troubles every decent and every compassionate person. My concern is the immediate future of this great country.
He pardoned Richard Nixon. Many Americans criticized Ford for doing this, but the new president believed he had good reason. Ford wanted to deal with the other problems facing the nation. He did not want Watergate to go on and on, but the investigation did go on. A number of officials in the Nixon administration went to prison. The effects of Watergate on public opinion and public policy would be felt for years to come. For example, Congress passed laws designed to prevent an administration from using its power to punish opponents. Nixon's abuses also led Congress to order government agencies to provide more information about their intelligence gathering activities. Nixon's actions violated the basic trust between the American public and their elected officials. It led to more aggressive reporting by a new generation of journalists hoping to follow in the footsteps of Woodward and Bernstein. Their coverage of Watergate won a Pulitzer Prize, one of journalism's top awards, and led to a movie based on their book, All the President's Men. It starred Robert Redford as Bob Woodward and Dustin Hoffman as Carl Bernstein. Jason Robards played Washington Post executive editor Ben Bradley.
You got more than one source.
Yes, sir. Yeah,
well, who are they?
Source.
Sloan.
Sloan
and who else?
And there's another guy, Justice, who so far won't confirm the names of the other two who control the fund that we're working on.
Right, deep throat.
He's not a source on this.
But do any of them have an axe?
No.
Personal, political, sexual? Is there anything at all on Mitchell?
No.
And can we use the names?
No.
When is somebody going to go on the record in this story?
You guys are about to write a story that says the former attorney general, the highest-ranking law enforcement officer in this country, is a crook. Just be sure you're right.
The presidency of Nixon's successor, Gerald Ford, will be our story on Sunday. Well, that's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. I hope you'll join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from the Voice of America.